The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. Welcome to BS Report. Very excited for this one. I've been writing a lot about the NBA lockout, ticket prices, attendance, all that stuff, where stuff's going, and I think that's a big part of this NBA lockout is the NBA owners are terrified about what this next decade is going to look like. So who better to talk about this with than the CEO of Ticketmaster, Live Nation? Is it there? Is there a hyphen? Ticketmaster hyphen?
Ticketmaster. It's just Ticketmaster. It's no part Live of Nation? Live Nation. Live Nation part is of Live the Nation. Big parent company.
Okay. We're Nathan with, Hubbard.
There you go.
That's his voice right there. What's happening?
Coming at you from the hot studio.
Yeah. You like that?
I'm digging it.
Should we sell tickets for the studio? What do you think?
I would give it a tour. I'm sure we can sell tickets.
Would you do dynamic pricing for it or just straight value?
Straight value on this one.
Let's talk about the NBA lockout first, because I met you a few months ago at a dinner and we were talking about it, and you were saying that the connection between sport, what's happened in sports with ticket pricing and what's happened with music and ticket pricing, is pretty much a lot of the same battles, would you say, or what are the differences?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think you've had for 30 years compound annual growth rate in ticket prices in the 8-10% across concerts and sports.
Right.
And 2010, when I first got into the chair at Ticketmaster, I came in the middle of the year. That year ended up being the single worst year-over-year decline in ticket sales in the 35-year history of our company. And it was pervasive. It was across sports. It was across concerts. It was everything. And so it was a time to step back and say, what's going on? This isn't just the economy, right?
Yeah, because you couldn't blame hockey or you couldn't blame... Yeah.
Right. And so as we dug into the data, and you've been writing about it, you know, the thing that bubbled up to the surface was, wow, we have a fan experience problem. Hmm. The event itself is awesome, but, you know, 6 months ago, there was a different competitive set for live events than there is today, right?
Yeah.
Angry Birds on your couch in your boxers is pretty fun, and it's pretty cheap, and it's competing, just like the HGTV is, with buying that ticket and going to the event. And
so you had the iPad is bad for tickets.
Yeah.
Internet, broadband internet.
Facebook, for crying out loud, right?
65-inch HGTVs.
Yeah. If you're a casual fan, you have so many other options to sit at home or, you know, do other stuff with your time and your money.
Yeah.
And I think in the live event industry, whether it was concerts or whether it was sports across the board, we sort of looked at it the same way and assumed that ticket prices would continue to creep up. We wouldn't necessarily need to innovate on the experience end to end, right? Mm-hmm. And life would continue. Well, a funny thing happened along the way, right? We turned into an e-commerce business. We sell at Ticketmaster probably 450 million tickets. 85% of those are sold online.
Really? 85%?
Right. So Ticketmaster now today is a top 5 e-commerce site in the world. And it sort of stumbled into it, right?
Yeah.
And we as an industry, live events, whether you're concert or sports, haven't really thought of ourselves that way.
Yeah.
As an e-commerce company, which is a different relationship with the customer. It's different, right? The way you price, the way you think about that. So so you've got a big fan experience problem in live events and a new competitive set. And so we have been, you know, taking responsibility for some of that. The buying experience has historically sucked to buy a ticket, let's be honest. Go Google your favorite artist or your favorite team today and put the word tickets next to it, and it's a crap show, right? There's inventory all over the place. If you just put your fan hat on, there isn't one great place to say, what are all my safe options to go to the show or the game tonight, right?
Yeah.
And that's hurting. That's hurting attendance.
So it wasn't until 2009 when you took a look back at the year in review of, all right, what happened with our sales? And you just saw across the board, something major is happening here that goes beyond just one factor.
Yeah. It starts with experience. The second is pricing, right? We are terrible at and I say we as an industry, Ticketmaster doesn't set the prices, but as an industry, we've historically been awful at setting the price at the intersection of supply and demand, right? So in a bunch of cases, we dramatically overprice inventory and it goes totally unsold.
Yeah.
And in a bunch of cases, we dramatically underprice it and it gets flipped and resold in the secondary market or hung on to.
Well, and what's worse, by the way?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you are, right? I mean, from a team perspective, let me put it this way. At Ticketmaster, 40% of our tickets go unsold.
Whoa.
Now, sometimes you can't give away Styx tickets in an arena, right, for a concert.
Yeah.
But there's no question that there's a lot of tickets that otherwise would go sold if you could find the right person and the right experience, right?
I mean, Yankee Stadium's a good example, right, where they kind of made the lower-level prices almost too high, and the seats were just empty. That's not good if you're a team.
No, I think that's right. And then I think you also have the sort of second layer of that onion is, think about Dodger Stadium, where you had a bunch of season ticket holders who bought tickets in the upper deck, but maybe some weren't season ticket holders, some were brokers. I mean, this is just one example. Every baseball team or every sports team has this issue where some of their season ticket holders are brokers.
Yep.
They buy them on, 20% of the games. They can make back their money.
Yep.
And then they have no incentive to do anything but dump the rest of the games. And if you're a fan, you're walking up to the box office saying, hey, I want a seat in the bleachers. They say, we're all sold out. And yet nobody's coming to those games in those upper deck seats because those tickets have either been dumped or thrown away. So the cyclical issues of the core pricing problem in sports and now that's sort of bleeding into concerts is affecting the fan experience. It's affecting the teams, right? They make 15, 20 bucks a head just when you walk in the door for merch and beer and popcorn and everything. So it's an economic challenge for sure. And at the core, and this is, something that we're thinking a lot about and working with the teams to think through, the season ticket is under attack.
Yeah.
Right? And for a fan, the secondary market has created great transparency around what the actual value of each individual game is.
Yeah.
Right? But it turns out that inherently, in a lot of cases, I mean, you're a Clipper season ticket holder, so you have your own thoughts on this. But in a lot of cases, season tickets are actually being sold for a lot less than they're worth.
Oh, I can vouch for the Clippers that that's the case. If you want to dump a ticket last minute, I'm not getting full value.
Yeah.
And also, I split my tickets with my friend Mike Tolan.
Right.
I don't know if I'd want to pay 41 Clipper games a year, plus exhibition, plus playoffs, and also to have good seats.
So my dad's a 30-year Redskins season ticket holder. And
right.
He's getting older, and, three games a season are at night, and it's cold in December and he doesn't want to drive home in the dark and when it's cold. So now he's starting to say, for a while he was selling some of his tickets in the secondary market. And now he's starting to say, well, maybe I don't need to buy the season ticket. I can just go to the games. And suddenly you have the unraveling of the core value of the product.
By the way, interesting irony there of your dad using the secondary market.
I know. At least he's using it through us now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
I was going to say, my dad's in the same situation. Season ticket holder for the Celtics in 74.
Yeah.
And every year he battles this battle of, do I want to get my tickets? My dad's now 64 years old, and he's got 41 home games plus playoffs, and they're in the playoffs.
Right.
Now you're talking 52 possibly home games a year plus preseason. He never wants to make his friends pay for a ticket for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so he's always trying to find who's going. Then, I don't want to go. Who do I get rid of these tickets to? And
right.
And he's just like, am I at the point now where I should just cherry pick the best 8 games I want to go to online and not worry about this other stuff?
Well, and that's a scary proposition for the teams. And the question is, tying it back to your NBA lockout, it's not just the NBA, it's every sports team. It's, can they now start to think about how to personalize the experience for everyone, right? I mean, we talked about the industry stumbling into being an e-commerce business. The future of the web, you guys are thinking about this, I'm sure, is sort of bending the web around each individual, right? Personalizing the experience online.
Using Facebook, using Reddit,
whatever it is, bend everything around you so that you're always logged in. Wherever you go, we're serving you up content, we're serving you up things that are relevant to you because we know you, we've fingerprinted you as a user, right?
Yep.
As a fan. That idea is starting to bleed into the in-game experience. And so you see a venue like Orlando, which besides being the center of the Cougar universe also happens to be a major town where they have thought really hard about how to create a bunch of really high-end experiences for people. And then also $5 seats up in the upper bowl. So they're thinking really tough creatively bounce. About how to fingerprint each user group of fan and sell them the right experience in the moment.
And cocktail waitresses for Tiger Woods. You forgot that demo. You got to keep getting those.
But I think you've talked about before, there are a lot of stadiums today that aren't built that way. That are built for a total uniform experience. And that at the core is affecting the fan experience in the game and affecting people's desire to come out versus sit at home and watch their awesome HGTV.
Well, isn't that one of the ironies here is that everybody's talking about state-of-the-art stadiums and either we need one or we just built one or we have to or we're planning on building one. And yet the word state-of-the-art is changing right now and nobody's adapting to that.
Right.
Like Sacramento.
Right.
They might build a basketball arena.
Right.
They're going to build a basketball arena that looks like the old arenas that were built from like 2000 and 2011. Unless they talk to you and people and say, hey, maybe you should build a 12,000 seat arena.
Yeah.
Gear it toward people and make it great.
That's right. And I think, the way that these teams are thinking about approaching their fans, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. Some of these sports teams, we think about them as these huge, big global brands. We sort of assign, a team, and we think about them like we think about General Motors or somebody else as a big, sophisticated organization. In most cases, they're not.
Right.
They're sometimes really dysfunctional family businesses, or, some of them are more functional. But what that means in practice is the way that they think about profiling their fans has not been particularly sophisticated. And by the way, Ticketmaster historically should have done a much better job of helping them get there.
Yeah.
But it turns out that we've got a ton of data. You tell me who your three favorite bands are, I can tell a lot about you, especially when I have your order history and I know a bunch of demographic, psychographic information about you. So we're trying to work with these teams to help them get to know their fan base better so that they can do things like offer the right package. Is it 8 games at an elevated price? Is it 8 of the worst games at for somebody who just wants to come to a cheap.
So wait a second. Are you saying so you have a digital fingerprint?
Sure. But they can use that to help build their stadiums to setting their season ticket prices, right? If you don't know who your fan is, how are you making those decisions other than just building sort of a mass arena that you pop up in Sacramento or wherever?
But let's say like AEG owns the Kings.
Yep.
They also own Staples Center, which has a bunch of concerts and all that stuff coming in. We got season tickets this year.
Yep.
It was my panic purchase because there wasn't going to be an NBA lockout. So I ended up getting King season tickets. I need winter sports in my life. I need a consistent winter sports thing. So potentially.
Plus hockey's back.
It's on the way back. Potentially they could take a digital fingerprint of me. Now they know I have King season tickets. They also know that I'm older, Pearl Jam, U2.
Right. No, me too.
Actually, I like some of the indie bands too. But so they could potentially send me emails and say, hey, dude, we'll let you buy 2 more Kings tickets, but you also this Pearl, and it'll be $750.
That's right. But beyond that, here's what we found. The average venue only sees about 20% of the live event spending activity of the people who come through their turnstiles, which means that most of what you buy is happening outside of that individual venue. So they come to us and go, you see that across markets, across venues within my market, and can help me say, okay, not only is this guy King's season ticket holder, but he also has a daughter who he took to the circus twice and Disney on Ice and we start to met. And by the way, these are the things he does before, during, and after the show. And when you start to
map that out. Because I'd obviously be a dad with the Disney on Ice, so you know that. So you'd start him with that.
That's right. Yeah. So can I tailor the right experience to you? And make no mistake about it, that's what a lot of these team folks who are involved in the venue are thinking about too, right? They're not just in the sports team business. They're also in the content business coming through their arenas. And so they're trying to think about how they bend the web, so to speak, around each individual fan.
But you're not afraid to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
Why are, for instance, I think this is the biggest reason we're having a lockout. And when I write about it, I don't think people fully understand what I'm talking about because the teams are almost acting like these Irish Catholic moms in the 50s that are pretending nothing bad's happening with dad at night, but at the same time, they need
a
lockout.
That's a creepy metaphor.
Well, it was creepy. I should have come up with a better one.
It's okay, I like that.
sleep with a baseball bat next to the bed. things are changing.
Yeah.
Why not just say that? Wouldn't the fans understand that if the team said, you know what, here's why we need a lockout and here's why we need more money from the players, because we're worried that you're not going to come anymore. Or we're worried that you want to come 8 times instead of 41, and we don't feel like we're prepared.
I don't pretend to judge how they're managing their brand, because I think that the league, basketball in particular, has done a fabulous job historically. But
right.
I think I know, and you probably do too, that behind the scenes they're having these conversations. They're not the record labels in denial about Napster and what it's doing to their business and pretending that we can just sort of sue it away.
Well, also, their stats are a lot more clearer than some of the music stats.
Well, that's
in the
right.
NBA, you can, here's attendance.
That's right.
And here's what the actual profit you made is, and here are all the deals you gave away to get people to come to your upper deck for $2.
That's right.
You can't really do that in music, can you? They're not doing it as much.
Not as much. We're getting there, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the reality of a concert today is, well, you could dramatically lower the seats on the lawn at, you know, Irvine Amphitheater here in LA, and increase the price up front, lower the average ticket price, but dramatically increase the amount of money that the artist would make, right? And I think in general, the secondary market's fascinating, because as you look at new revenue streams, there's about $4 billion that's happening in the secondary market on the backs of the work that, you know, the content is doing. I say content broadly, the teams, the artists, whoever it is, right? Mm. Disney, the circus, whatever. And that's a massive growth opportunity if they can just figure out how to price their inventory right. We as an industry are like the last Wild West frontier that doesn't set the price at the intersection of supply and demand. We don't, you know, we set a price for an event, whether it's a sporting event or a concert, and we go on sale 3, 4, 6, 9 months before the event happens, and we don't change the price through time, right? When the data says that whether it's the weather or because Britney decided to shave her head or because Britney came back and she's on a comeback, that the value of that changes in real time. We do it with gas, we do it with soap, we do it with milk, we do it with airlines and hotels, we don't do it with tickets. And I think we will.
Would you say that the airline model is the closest to where you want to get? Is it too different?
So here's the thing. If you take it to the extreme, you get to the Elizabethan theater model with all the rich D-bags up front and the, and the plebes in the back, right?
Right.
And that's not how you build a lifelong value of a fan, right? You fell in love with the Celtics because of your seats.
Yeah.
I felt, you know, my experience is, I don't know, in D.C., I happened to get 2 front row tickets to see La Lovett when I was 16, took my 14-year-old sister. We sat front row. It was awesome. I've seen him 25 times since. Never would have done it if I had been in the back, I'm sure.
That's right? Why you hate Julia Roberts so much now.
I do. In fact, I was there that night when he announced on stage on Wolf Trap.
You're like, no!
He kept thanking this woman, Fiona, because he was trying to be like, you know, crazy.
Too cool for school?
Too cool, like, I know her middle name. And
oh, anyway. God.
I'm still scarred to this day. Anyway.
So you're worried that you don't want to head to a place where just rich people get the
best seats.
That's
right. You need to build a lifelong fan. And so these aren't mutually exclusive concepts. Can we figure out how to get the kid who pays $35 for a ticket that's really worth $350 into the gate at $35 while at the same time taking some of the inventory and selling it for what it's worth in the open market? I don't think those are mutually exclusive concepts. And these teams and these artists as, you know, what they are today, brand managers, sorry, but that's the world we live in, right, are starting to and need to more aggressively think about how they price their inventory that way.
Season tickets, why wouldn't I just get an 8-game package or a 10-game package over buying 41 games?
I think the teams have to give you that answer. And that's part of why in Orlando they're creating these really cool in-game experiences so that they can tie it not just to seat quality, but to the actual entire experience, right? Both in the game and then opportunities outside of it. And the most creative guys
have
figured that out.
Like when you say in-game experience.
Staples, right?
Yeah.
Staples, maybe not the right example. In Orlando, there are probably 3, 4, 5 different VIP areas, depending on your level of purchase, that you can go be a part of, right?
Like a little red rope society.
Sure. But then all year long, access to, I'm sure you've been invited to Mr. Sterling's white party at the...
I didn't get that invitation.
Really?
I'm not on the list.
They don't love you?
They don't like it. Don Sterling doesn't like
you. Probably live
that.
Down the road, I'm sure.
I don't think he
he doesn't want you in his house.
Yeah, he doesn't want me.
He wears black to that thing, by the way. He does. It's awesome. So, but those kinds of things, the equivalent of the white party elsewhere. No, but where they're trying to really reward the season ticket holder and provide that value. Because Otherwise, what you have now is a proliferation of people who are buying those season tickets for different reasons than they think. And by the way, the secondary market, I think, is a totally legitimate distribution channel. It's a way for teams to shift risk. I just think they're shifting too much risk, and I think it's starting to eat at their core business. And a lot of them know that, and we're helping them start to sort through it.
Paperless tickets.
Yeah. So that
just seems super duper logical to me. All right, we make all these paperless. Now there's a trail. Yeah. If I buy tickets and now LeBron gets traded and he's coming to town and that ticket's worth five times what I was supposed to be worth, and I sell that ticket on eBay, the team should get some of that money, a percentage. Yeah. How do you get there?
I think that's right, and I think we're not that far away. I mean, I think, you know, the logical conclusion of that is a digital ecosystem where the content participates in the transaction no matter where it happens. And, you know, look, there's a little bit of a legislative battle because some of the scalpers and StubHub don't like that world.
Do they think it's unconstitutional?
No, I think that when your business model is in trouble, you go to the state legislatures and try to introduce laws. That's a telltale sign that your business is in trouble, I think. And they're well organized, and they've fortunately not had too much success. We've been spending some money. We got a lot of clients and artists who've stood up against it. At the end of the day, it's about who gets to control the ticket, who gets to participate in that.
But it's the only business where we have scalpers. Like when I sold my book.
Yeah, nobody was scalping your book.
Well, I'm just saying, like, imagine if people could only buy...
They signed once.
Well, people could only buy, let's say only 15,000 people could buy the book at the price we did it.
Right.
And then everybody else, the scalpers, just bought the book. And then They're like, here's the book, and it's $75 now. Right. But yet I was only getting the royalties for the $25 price. I would flip out. Yeah. I'd kill everybody. I'm on the side with the bands on that.
I am too. And I think our job is to help them participate. And so, look, step one is something like we're doing with the NFL right now. So we power the NFL's official secondary ticket exchange. It's safe. You trust the brand. And it's pulled a significant share away from the
rest of the
secondary.
Well, explain that. So I have season tickets. I put them on this website.
Put them on the anybody NFL ticket exchange. Anybody can buy them. And it's safe. It's approved. It's league approved. And the teams all participate in that, right? We'd like to find ways to do the same thing.
Do they
thing
get a commission?
Ours. They do.
What's the commission?
I don't know. The deals work. We make guarantees to all the teams. And, and then we make it up in royalties. So...
Can you set the price for any price?
As a fan, you can do whatever you want. Yeah.
So if I had that,
so it's a fan marketplace.
The Heat are coming to the Clippers. I can't go. Yep. I put them on this website. Let's say the face value is $350 for the pair. I put it on for $1,200. I get that.
Yep.
How much of that money do I get? Or the Clippers would get like
10%? The Clippers are going to get a percent. You know, I mean, on average in the secondary market, you know, between the buyer and seller fees, the transaction gets taxed 20, 25%, something like that. And so the teams participate in a significant portion of that.
Does the government get anything? No.
Outside of like standard e-commerce taxes, whatever they may be, no.
Oh, don't tell the government about this. Okay. They might just grab some.
Amazon's playing defense on all that, I think. But. But listen, we pay a lot of taxes.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the NFL has sort of pioneered that. USTA through US Open is doing some of that. I think you're going to see, you know, the NHL doing a little bit of stuff. You're going to see more leagues step up and say, this is our brand. We're going to continue to build our brand. And if you just think about the ticket buying experience with your fan hat on, which the industry has sucked at historically, You fall on a grid. What's, you know, one axis is the cost of the seat, the other axis is the quality of the seat. You as a fan are a point on that graph somewhere.
Yeah.
And there's no great place today to just go and find the right experience for you, find your point on that graph. And that's the problem we're trying to solve.
The paperless ticket thing seems so easy. I mean, you could even go a step further and make it like it's almost like a card that you'd have in college. Yeah. You know the card you'd get when you'd scan and your meals are on that card?
Right. I mean,
you could go, yeah, exactly.
At the end of the day, it should be your phone.
So
I think we are absolutely as a business headed there. We got to.
Really? Absolutely.
It has to because.
So you're saying on the iPhone, basically, you just hold your iPhone out and your ticket that you bought is on there and nobody else can have that code unless you pass it along.
Right. Unless you transfer it across. Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, you've seen it because I think you've been busted before, but look at a picture of a average sports crowd and look at what they're doing.
Busted.
50% of them are looking down, right,
right,
at their mobile devices.
It's
the device that, it's part of how they will enhance the in-game experience. I mean, there's an interesting debate over that, right? Mark Cuban will say, if you're looking down, I'm failing.
Right.
He actually,
I don't agree with
him. Yeah, I don't either. But he happens to be one of the most innovative in-game entertainment guys in all of sports, right, in terms of the content that they put up in the venue when you're at a game. I don't agree with him either, but he's smarter than I am, so what do I know? But I think that the device will become an integral part of that game. And, I mean, just the other night, I was at a concert, and I held up my phone. I took a bunch of footage, and I realized I had all this content on my phone. I didn't have any place to put it, right? So the mobile device not only is going to be, now it is that content capture thing for the Blair Witch Red Sox stuff that, you know, is awesome, but it ought to also be your ticket, and it also, you know, it's sort of your connection to that live event. And so that's the second problem that we're trying to think about is there's 2 hours of amazing passion and energy in a sporting event or a concert. And then it dies, right? There's 20,000 of the most passionate people in the world in this moment. How do you extend the passion, the energy of that event around, you know, before, during, and after the show? There's no great place for, Facebook's good if you have some friends. It's good to trade the memories of the people you were with. But there's no way to replicate the energy and the passion of that crowd. And I think some of the leagues are trying to do that. We're trying to help them get there and expand the experience. Because again, if you don't make it great, they're going to do other things.
You talked about the dysfunctional family analogy when you got to Ticketmaster and you were kind of like, why do we do it this way? Would you say this falls into the category of we did it that way because that's the way we always did it?
Yeah.
And nobody ever thought about changing it?
I think that's exactly right.
Well, we've always had tickets and you print them out and I give them to you and that's how we do it.
Right. Well, of course we charge you print at home fees for you to print it on your own paper and your own ink, right? So the last year we spent a ton of time with our clients. We got 50% of the tickets that we sell don't have print at home fees anymore. Why? Because it's dumb and fans don't understand it and it ticks them off. And
it is dumb. You have to make sure you're in your printer. Oh, my printer doesn't
totally
work.
Is.
What do I do? You're
no,
panicking.
And the fees in general, right? I mean, what happened through, I mean, we started talking about ticket price, but through time, ticket prices have continued to grow. And the artist, as the record industry collapsed, right, it used to be the artist would make 90% of their money from the record or from the recorded music, 10% from the tour. Today, it's totally flipped. So they're making all their money on the road. And as they've started to make more and more of the face value of the ticket price, the artist's partners, the venue, the promoter, whatever, started to make their money from other ways, including the fee, right? Mm-hmm. It's really just an extension of the ticket price. Amazon, when you go buy, you know, your book on Amazon, they're taking 20% or whatever they take, right? They don't show it to you, call it a convenience fee, and, you know, make you think that actually Bill's only getting $20 or
right.
Your publisher's only getting $20 and Amazon's taking $5, right?
Right.
That's what we've done as a business. Again, just backwards thinking that doesn't connect with how people are used to buying stuff online.
Or that it was just so late with all the stuff that was happening.
Totally.
Internet, mobile devices,
the
consumer habits, everything was changing over the last 10 years. You would think ticket prices would be the most inflexed.
No, right. And so we started from a position of, okay, how do we make the fan experience cooler? And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, like go check out Anaheim Ducks tickets now. You'll see we've got these interactive seat maps that are really cool. Guess what? When people use them, they buy more. We did it.
By the way, those I like the interactive
seat maps.
They're cool.
Have you seen the Facebook integration?
There's some good ones.
So like you can now go in and see everybody who's logged into Facebook can tag themselves and see like individual people where they're sitting, who they are. So cool stuff that is actually innovative for once, you know. So we've been really focused on the user experience because you know, again, we just as an industry, we haven't thought fan first. Ticketmaster is a company that really built itself for the team or the venue box office manager, not thinking fan first. And so transforming the business that way, you know, we think is the key to moving the industry forward. So
let's talk about music, because that's how you got into this whole thing. Once upon a time, you were in a band. What was the band's name?
U2. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
I forgot you're the bassist.
That's what I am. I'm the cymbal player. I was in a crappy band called Rockwell Church.
And then somehow this led to...
So, do the
2 minute
the 2 minute
story.
Thing. Yeah, no. Okay. So the short history is in college. I was like a, you know, suburban wussy acoustic rock singer songwriter.
Nice.
With the kid I sat next to in first grade.
You cried when Elliot Smith died.
All
that
the
kind
time.
Of stuff. Okay.
Yes, I still do. Stop it. I'm all getting right. choked. I'm verklempt. And so coming out of college, I did that for a couple of years and toured around, played a couple hundred shows a year all over the country, fun.
Yeah.
But learned how, you know, fundamentally that still informs what I do today, because learned how an artist thinks about connecting directly with his fans, right? Mm-hmm. How do I reach him? How do I grow that fan base? How do I nurture it? Right, you know, in the 90s as the internet is exploding and people are figuring out, what does a web page do? The same thing that you were thinking about, how do I get my content directly to people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And did that for a couple of years, and then my best friend, we were driving, and he turned to me in Iowa somewhere and said, "My dad's going to kill me if I don't go to grad school." And so I said, "Shit, I better go figure out what else I got to do."
Yeah.
And we went off and did other things, started a company. But I always wanted to get back into music, and so I jumped into a company that. Was in the music space. One thing led to another. We got bought by Live Nation, and then Live Nation was Ticketmaster's largest client. We were leaving Ticketmaster. We did that successfully. I led that initiative, so we were Ticketmaster's biggest competitor, and then the merger. Yeah, so when that was done, you know, for 6 years or something, I'd been either Ticketmaster's largest competitor or their largest client, and. So I knew.
So you kind of know where the weaknesses are.
I knew a lot of the soft spots,
yeah.
And so I think that's why they asked me to go jump in and run it. And you know, the amazing thing for me is you build up. You know, it's like being a you build up. It's like two teams playing each other. Cowboys, Redskins, right? As a Redskin, Chris Cooley making fun of Tony. You build up so much hate, so much anger, and you get underneath the surface and you realize, wow, Ticketmaster has been a bulletproof vest for the rest of the industry for a long time. And to change all the things that I hated about Ticketmaster as a kid, right? Being a Pearl Jam fan like you, right?
Yeah.
You really have to start to transform the industry. And the only way that I know to do that is to talk openly about it.
That's how I feel about ESPN, even as I was working for it the last 10 years. So the music part of this.
Yeah.
The industry has just changed completely. And as you mentioned a couple minutes ago, you talked about how the bands now make all of their money on the road.
Yeah.
This is really hurting music because bands aren't in the studio making songs and albums and writing things and thinking, because all of their money that they have to make is on the road. I think that's going to be bad for the next 10 years. What do you think?
Maybe. I think that, look, Pro Tools was one of the biggest inventions. Pro Tools is like the, you know, bands can, in this room right here, make an amazing professional sounding album on a Mac Air. Right,
so you're saying in a hotel room they could do stuff,
and so it's changed the ability of bands to really create content. So I'm not sure that hurts the art so much as I think this, and you know, it's not even a word, but the nicheification of music, right? That starts the original argument was, wow. You know, the Wired magazine article about the long tail that said digital music age is going to be incredible. You know, all these artists are going to come to the surface and it's going to be a renaissance for music. I think that's true in that, you know, artists can find distribution in ways that they couldn't ever before. You know, the challenge is, you know, there's a lot of crap out there.
Right.
And so what you're actually seeing now is... Maybe not, but the death of the great rock star, right? Are there going to be bands with long careers playing arenas going forward, or is the future 5,000-seat, 2,000-seat venues, you know, Adele's of the world?
Playing the Super Bowl in 2030?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who's playing the Super Bowl this year? It's Madonna, who is fabulous, and it's a great show, but the question is,
she's 52.
Will Bieber do that in 30 years, right? And that to me is the most interesting part. I mean, we looked at the gross concert sales like 3 or 4 years ago from, call it 2008, 2009, and like 25% of the total ticket sales were like 60-year-olds, so we're going to be dead or retired, you know, in 10 years. So the question is, what is the next generation?
My counter to that question would be, was it always like that? There's that famous 90210 episode.
Here we go.
Where the Walsh parents got tickets to the Rolling Stones. Yeah. Mr. Walsh is like, yeah, I'm playing the Rolling Stones. And the kids are like, oh, cool, the Rolling Stones. And anybody watched that was like, the Rolling Stones. That's like, they're not cool anymore.
Yeah.
And part of me wonders if that's just always what happens.
Well, maybe, but I think that today, more than ever, I mean, I think the digitization of music has, you know, and even the latest integration of Spotify and Facebook, you know, just from the last month, if you've popped on your Facebook page, you're seeing a discovery and a renaissance of all kinds of new artists. And I think it turns out that, right, 20 years ago, there were 30 slots for hit songs on radio, right? And so those 30 artists got really, really big because we were only giving you 30 flavors of ice cream. Today, there are 10,000 flavors of ice cream, right? And so what you need and you and I both need, because we don't have enough time, is somebody to help curate the 10,000 songs that I can put on my iPhone. What are the 100 that I really want to listen to?
I just want to say that I still find the time.
Well, good for you.
I have to. I force myself, like every 2 months.
That's what I have.
To just go on iTunes
and
just
see what the hell is going.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Go to the Alt Nation Facebook page. I have all my little tricks. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Because, oh, this band.
Exactly.
But I do wonder, you know, it's so much harder to tell who's made it and who hasn't. Like, it almost feels like...
Yeah, we're redefining success, for sure.
Like, if you're on SNL...
It meant
a lot 30 years ago. I still feel like it means something now.
It means matter.
Somebody made it. That means like, all right, well, at least they're doing well enough that they got the SNL call.
That's right. I'm not sure it affects their sales.
I don't think it affects their sales either. I think it once did, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or if you're on Letterman, I don't feel like that affects... I don't think late-night TV affects bands anymore.
It doesn't. When a tree falls in the woods, I think. But it's... Listen, it's an important... it's an important point, because I think artists have to reimagine what they are. The successful artists going forward, and even I have to tell you, the successful artists today are people who really at the core are entrepreneurs and career managers. Like,
yeah,
they're thinking about themselves differently. They
like
understand the web. Lady Gaga, Jay-Z, Bono. I mean, even
Kanye.
The biggest rock stars right now, they behind the scenes know they're managing a persona, know they're managing a fan base, and they're thinking about those touch points. And that's a different skill set, honestly, than artists have historically had. And so either they got to find really great managers, or they themselves have to be thinking in a different way.
Well, think about when we were like teenagers or in college, and you had a new band that you didn't know,
right,
but you really liked one of their songs.
Right.
And there was always that big moral dilemma of, am I ready to spend $13.99 on their CD? But yet I don't know if any of the other songs are good. So Jim Grady, my old buddy, and I had we had a two-song rule. If they had two, it was justifiable. If it was three, it was a no-brainer.
Right.
You're getting three songs. There's probably one more you like. But now it's iTunes. You just download the one song. You don't even have to care about the rest of the album.
Or Spotify. Like, I heard about this guy named Jonathan Wilson, who's a little geeky folky like I used to be, and I went and I checked out, you know, 20 of his songs for nothing today. Now the question is, what Jonathan's hoping is, it was cool enough for me to go buy a ticket. And so we have to make
or
that
maybe
transition.
His album, maybe,
maybe, but with Spotify, I never would, right? Because I just am subscribed and I go through it. So and I think he's okay with that. I think he, you know, my job from the Ticketmaster side is to make that jump really easy from discovery to purchase. And there's a lot of people trying to unlock that discovery thing. How do I, again, fingerprint you, Bill? Tell me 10 artists you like, and whether I'm Pandora or Spotify or iTunes Genius, I'm going to bend my music catalog around you and introduce you on that night when you and I go until 6 in the morning trying to discover new bands. I'm going to introduce you to 100 that you haven't heard of, and you're going to like 90 of them because I know you that well.
Could it be something where you're on Spotify, and if you play more than 3 songs, they start popping up virtual concert dates in your area?
Exactly. All of that can, and in 6 months will be integrated, the extent to which it isn't already. Go to YouTube today, you'll see those listings. Go to in a lot of places today. So you have to make that a seamless buying experience and make it easy.
I think musicians are screwed. I mean, it's just so hard to be seen through the clutter.
Well, that's right, but I think that people who work hard will earn it, and I think that it will force these artists to build longer careers. I mean, look, we say that, but
earn what, though? Nobody's buying albums anymore.
But
they're earning 99 cent iTunes
songs.
Make
a lot of money off the road, make a lot of money off of licensing. I mean, look, Bieber went from nowhere to where he is today in a very, very,
he's multiple
very
bodyguards.
Short period of time, right?
Yeah.
He has multiple. He's probably got guard dogs. He's got
animals.
He's
got bodyguards for his bodyguards.
And animals.
And animals.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that tells you that people can accelerate really fast. I mean, you know, this is the shocker for me, and it's not probably for us because we got daughters, but the, you know, the one of the biggest selling acts out there right now is Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift is playing stadiums.
I'm not shocked.
Stadiums.
Well, maybe that's where part of the business is going, is the kids are going to drive the parents.
And I think
my
think
daughter
that's
wants
right.
to see Katy Perry. She wants to see Taylor Swift.
Yep.
Who's the other one? There's one more in that vortex of mediocrity.
Now I can't answer that.
Now you
that
can't
question.
Answer that question.
No.
I feel like it's personally.
Tiffany?
You probably
Debbie,
love, no, I forget. No. Yeah, she loves all those.
For me, it's
she
Jay
likes Jesse J.
Yeah, Jesse J. She loves.
My daughter is a CD.
Miley Cyrus.
How old's your daughter?
7 and 5.
Oh, yeah. Mine's 6 and a half. So she has all her music on her little CD. She knows all the words.
Yeah.
She knows all the words to that Jesse J song. It's all about the. Ka-ching, ka-ching. Yeah. It's all about the.
Have you caught him on YouTube yet?
She's just learning how to type in the words, and she's been typing in a lot of Beavis and Butthead and getting in trouble.
Yeah, I caught her searching for Miley Cyrus videos on YouTube, and she watched one concert video, and then she found the smoking the bong video.
Yeah, that's not good. You got to be.
Good.
They might have to put more YouTube parental things in there.
No good.
But I will say though, it's amazing how much is on YouTube in terms of discovering bands. Like, if you like a band now, that's something I think is underrated. It's not just about the iTunes.
Yeah.
You can go and see concert footage. That's now the cameras are so good. It's like somebody in the second row.
Yep.
And you can see them in concert and decide whether you want to see them in concert.
But, you
or
know,
not.
That's an important point you just said. They are giving away their music on YouTube right now.
Which isn't a great thing.
Which may not be for the artist.
Yeah.
Which may not be for the artist unless it's a vehicle for merch and tour and other promotion. You know, it's a way to be discovered. And I think social, you know, the two great platforms of our lifetime are going to be social and mobile. And I think the artists who use those well are going to rise to the surface, assuming that their content is really good.
You know, I was reading this book. It hasn't come out yet. I think it comes out next week. It's about MTV. It's an oral history. And it's an oral history of the first 11, 12 years. It's called I Want My MTV.
Yeah,
it's
excellent. It's actually really great.
It's really good. I ripped through it. I love oral histories in general, but this one was so in my wheelhouse and in your wheelhouse because it's MTV from basically 81 through 92. Mm-hmm. And a lot of how the videos are made and stuff. Yeah. And what struck me is, you know, I would say Kings of Leon is one of the most successful bands of the last 5 years, right?
Have you seen the special on them, by the way?
Which one?
The Showtime thing?
No.
Oh, God, you got to see it. Okay, keep going.
Is it a behind, like a 24/7 behind the scenes
thing? It will change your impression of this band, but go ahead.
They've had trouble dealing with success.
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
Most of them do.
I am a big music guy. I am a big pop culture guy.
Yeah.
I could not tell you the lead singer's name.
Yeah, Caleb.
Caleb something.
Yeah.
So, but it does seem like there's an anonymity.
And that's because of the lack of the video? Or what's your...
I think because we don't have music videos now, that music videos aren't a part of culture the way they once were.
Yeah.
In the 80s, we knew everybody's name in every video.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, we knew, like, the bassist in Van Halen.
Right.
We knew every lead singer, you named it. I could have told you Kaja Gugu, like, anything. You name it, I knew it. And now I wonder if people just see the name of the band, unless you're really into it. It's just strange to me. Foster the People. What's that guy's name?
Yeah, I don't know.
And that's probably the biggest crossover hit, or one of them.
That's a fair point.
Well,
look,
the past
they're bringing back Beavis and Butthead. Maybe they'll bring back videos.
Maybe. Or maybe you watch these videos now and you're like, we watched these for 4 solid minutes for pop for 20 in a row for 2 hours?
Yeah. And look, you just can't justify the cost anymore, right? As the return has gone down. So... it's changed the way we consume it for sure. I just am, unlike you, I'm hopeful that it gives rise, and I think it is giving rise, to the indie artist who really manages his career better. It means that it's a lot less likely you're going to make it to the stadium, like Taylor Swift, but I think it's a lot more likely that you're going to make it to the House of Blues.
Katy Perry at Staples Center, my friend Scott Hanley told me this, sold out 3 Staples shows in a row. And then they did 3 more, and she sold out all 3 of those.
Yeah.
So you can't say the concert business is in that much trouble, because it's not. Because there are acts that sell.
Young girls drive the consumption of music.
That was the case in 1965.
It's the same thing today.
So that's not going away.
No.
Young girls becoming better on the internet.
Scares the crap out of me.
Our daughters who can get on YouTube already at age 7. That might ultimately be a good thing for the internet. The iPad might be a good thing if you're a music fan, because now you have this thing that you're carrying around with you all the time. You can download songs, you can watch video, you can do everything all at once on this one little machine.
I agree, and I think, you know, that's an interesting point on concerts. I mean, we are so stupid in our industry in that there are 10,000 seats available and, you know, 1 million people line up for the Radiohead show. Sorry, 2,000 seats available for Radiohead in New York a couple weeks ago. 1 million people line up, And after we sell the 2,000 tickets, we close the box office window and don't give the rest of the people any experience at all.
Right? You're just screwed. Go home. You lost. Go home, losers.
Right. And isn't there a way that they, and we think there is, a way that those people can experience the show on their iPad at home, by the way, for a fee, just like pay-per-view or, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe like $15 and you get to watch it like a pay-per-view?
Yeah, I mean, shouldn't there be a Sunday ticket for concerts that are sold out, right?
Ooh. How would the Red Zone channel work?
You just switch between Katy Perry and Taylor Swift and the other mediocre female artists.
Could you do season tickets for music? Could I say, like, hey, Staples Center, I'll buy 20 concerts from you for a certain price, and I'm in, and these are my seats every time I go.
You could. I mean, that's what suite holders, by definition, are doing today. Right.
Right.
So they get that access. We do that in the amphitheater business on the Live Nation side around the country today. You can buy a season pass.
So you really sound like you think it's going toward amphitheaters.
No, I think the amphitheater business is really strong. What I think you're going to see a big rise of is those mid-tier clubs, the Fillmores, the, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 seat. This is just my own personal opinion. I think those are going to be really strong because I think you're going to have a lot of artists that bubble up, but don't get the huge, massive stardom that the old radio record store structure would create. So I think you're still going to have those artists who play those larger venues, but more and more I think you're going to see. And as a fan, that's a great thing because an intimate experience is always the best. So,
and maybe we're too nostalgic with this stuff. Like, it bothers me that maybe albums aren't going to mean anything to my daughter at all. Whereas, like, I have certain albums, and we're all of that generation. Like, we have the A side, B side.
Lady of My Life would never be on Thriller, and
right. Yeah, they'd be like, all right, I'm going to talk myself into this terrible,
no,
probably
this really
terrible
cool
song. Yeah,
please go back to PYT. No, yeah,
it is kind of sad though. Because I feel like the album, it's almost like it's a difference of, hey, I wrote this whole book.
Yeah.
And hey, here's a chapter for my book.
But,
and now we're buying chapters.
Okay, but the Occupy Wall Street perspective on that is, screw you, you were charging me $15 for something that was only worth one. So
they had a perspective?
I don't know. Maybe I'm.
I just thought they were trying to occupy stuff. I didn't realize there was a perspective behind it.
I could have used the Irish Catholic 50s mom analogy there, but
we're one for one with bad analogies.
Tie. So anyway, I think again, the concert experience going forward is it's fascinating to us. What we care about is that people still pay for access. So we're pushing hard on making the experience great from end to end.
I think the music business, even though, as you said, I don't know if there's the mega artists anymore. There's going to be the mega artists to the kids' generation.
Yeah.
I don't, like, in this book, I Want MTV, like, in 84, you had the peaks of Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen,
right,
and Madonna broke onto the scene as well. Plus, like, Prince. Like,
oh, right, YouTube.
It's just
right,
mega stars left and right. YouTube, everybody in different genres breaking.
But let's contextualize that. I mean, every single art form has a life, right? And if you think about jazz and before that, classical music, they all had a heyday. The rock and roll era has been alive since the 50s.
Yeah.
Here we are in year 60 plus of that traditional art form with, you know, 1-4-5 chord progressions. But at some point, we're going to get tired of that. And so you wonder if we're at a point where we're moving into a new, you know, where technology is changing the art form and that we're sort of at the tail end of what can be done within the traditional boundaries. I mean, you know, we talk about dying art form, but the electronic music scene is exploding. I mean, from the Ultra Music Festival to you know, Deadmau5.
Exploding with people our age, too.
Well, and yeah.
A lot of, like, people who are, like, having
the Burning
before
Man,
midlife
right,
crises. Right. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Well, like, my wife won't let me go to Burning Man, so I'm going to sneak down
idea
to the Electric Daisy Festival and pretend I'm not on drugs. But I think that to me is the really interesting question, is whether we're at that inflection point where we're progressing to a new art form. That's, you know, the optimist in you would say that just means there's amazing new innovation ahead. The pessimist would say, how many times can you rewrite a Beatles song and put new words on it and pretend it's yours?
Well, Oasis would say you have a 3-year shelf life there, and then you get trouble.
They'll break down this door.
I would say rap is in the biggest problem area for that, because I think that's a form that they're, you just look at it now, it's like, where is this form going?
Yeah, the horse is dead and beaten, but I'm not sure I agree with you that it's any different than some of the other traditional, I mean.
Disco, how long did disco last? Yeah, I guess disco exactly. Kind of came back though.
Well, I don't know where it is
today. Tiny bit, sort of, maybe, yeah. A little bit.
But that's a great example of how it was almost like a gateway drug to the rebirth of rock in the 80s, right? Or the, you know, Renaissance in the 70s. So we'll see. But I think that today, the good news today is it's easier to find and listen to music than ever before. Music consumption is at an all-time high.
And cheaper.
Yeah. The people aren't necessarily paying for it, but consumption is at an all-time high. And so the people who can filter down the crap and feed you, know you, Bill Simmons, everything that you like, and tailor new stuff to you, those are going to be the people who win.
I'll never forget spending like $13.99 for The Outfield in 1985, just hoping that they had more than two songs.
Being so bummed.
Yeah, I just remember
my Tom Cochran Life is a Highway album. Yeah. That one did not make
it. How many times did you buy a bad album and just go, oh, man. There's only two songs in there.
Which is so good. Now, that's the way it should be, right?
Right.
And that is the exact same analogy, I think, unless I'm going Irish Catholic mother on you here. That's what's happened with season tickets, right? Is people felt like they were getting, in some cases, bundled stuff that they didn't want, and give the secondary marketplace credit. They've created a fluid market that actually values, debundles, decouples those things, and gives fans the personalized experience that they want. So
if you're
that for a transition,
that was pretty good. So if you're an NBA owner right now,
yeah, God forbid.
How do you make this point to the players that your business is changing without them thinking you're lying?
I think data tells the story. I mean, you've written enough about it, so I don't need to opine on that. But I think the facts really are there. And whether it's – and I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but the data is there. And all you got to do is survey 10,000 NBA fans, and they're going to tell you exactly what we've been talking about. And the teams know it. And I'm not so sure the players don't know it.
I feel like they kind of don't. I definitely think Billy Hunter is in total denial, because it seems like everything the players are doing right now is based on what already happened.
Yeah.
We went, well, this is, you can't take us because this is how we did it, and you can, and we can't go here. And it's like, dudes, it's changing. Your sport's in more trouble than maybe you realize. I think hockey and basketball, just those 41 home games a year. I think football's in better shape because it's really not a huge commitment.
No.
It's eight games, you get two preseason, and maybe one
or
two playoffs.
Although I even think in the League of Football, they're thinking about, I mean, their in-game experience at the venue is not as good as being at home because of the stats and all that, right? So
winners in big, and start talking about that.
But look, well,
I think
they are.
Sucks to go to football games.
What's cool is I think it's pushing innovation. And so whether it's tagging each player with a chip that, you know, tracks their stats, and in-game you get, if you're there, you can, you know, read everything that they're doing and stats. I mean, I think it's going to push. There's a cool opportunity for as much venture capital as is flying around right now. There's a really cool opportunity for companies that can innovate in that area and make the in-game experience cool using technology. And that's why the mobile device, I think, is so important to the in-game experience.
The one thing I forgot to ask you, once upon a time, Ticketmaster was the quote-unquote villain.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam, one of my favorite bands.
Mine
had a
too.
Lot to do with that.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was deserved, I feel like. I mean, but things have changed. But yet you still are considered
the
villain
devil.
To some degree.
Yeah.
How do you battle that?
Yeah, I mean, it has been what I've spent a ton of the last 18 months on. Again, I think we've been trying to get out and tell the truth and talk about what Ticketmaster is great at and what it's bad at. And I think historically, Ticketmaster has been the bulletproof vest for the rest of the industry.
Yeah.
That a lot of bad practices and lack of transparency has sort of hid behind, right?
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work in the time that we live in. And so
it's too easy for people to mobilize. It's too easy for people to do stuff.
Yeah.
You know, this happened and that happened. And then it's their fault.
No,
right.
No.
There.
And I get it. Listen, I grew up, I mean, I say this every day. I grew up hating Ticketmaster. I hated that they set the convenience fees so high and kept all the money. I hated that they moved tickets between the primary and secondary market. I hated that they kicked me out on the on sale. And then you get under the covers and you realize Ticketmaster actually doesn't do any of those things. Ticketmaster is a online marketplace, and that a lot of the industry has hid behind. And so, speaking
when you say a lot of the industry, who are you talking about?
Well, I think everybody from team, artist, venue, promoter, everybody who's engaged in the show.
And they just blame Ticketmaster when they had as much culpability as
historically,
anybody?
That has been Ticketmaster's job. And it just doesn't work. I mean, you know this. In an online e-commerce transaction, if you have an angry consumer, it means that some percentage of the time they're deciding not to buy. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work anymore. It's a model that worked for a long, long time. It doesn't work anymore. And 2010 was actually a really helpful year for me because I can go to all my clients and say, you see the declines? There's something fundamentally wrong here. And yeah. We don't need a bad guy in this industry anymore. These are the issues: pricing, awareness, fan experience. These are the 100 things that we're doing to solve them. Everybody get on the train and let's solve it. So,
well, it seems like you're doing that logically, and David Stern has done that more combatively. I wonder if he's in the sense of this is wrong and it's got to fix and we need more money and this has to change now. Maybe if he had just may have been more transparent from the get-go, like, hey, look, man, our business is changing. We're like really worried here. We might have to lose some teams.
Yeah.
Maybe if he had been just more honest from the get-go, people wouldn't feel like the NBA is trying to pull something over. Like, the players don't trust him. The fans don't trust anything.
You were like a 9.2 on the about-to-go postal over this scale.
I really miss the NBA.
You have like the crazy, desperate housewife look in your eye right now. Like, I'm afraid
we're starting in 3 weeks.
I know. We're not.
Well, we're not starting in 3 weeks.
I know.
I'm mad because the Celtics come once a year, and I moved to L.A. in 2002, and every year the Celtics-Clipper game has been one of my favorite days of the year because it's my team.
I know. But it's more than that for you because the last year of NBA basketball was transformational.
Fantastic. And, yeah.
And it was fabulous.
Don't you agree with me that we should, instead of having a federal mediator, they should just pick like 8 or 9 smart people from different fields that all care? You and I'm going to nominate both of us, to
Thank
be
you.
Honest. And we all serve as the common sense mediators and just be like, hey, fellas, let's lock ourselves in the room for 20 hours until we can get out of here and figure this out. Now, we're taping this on Tuesday, October 17th?
Yes.
18th.
18th.
So if by the time we play this, if the lockout gets miraculously settled, then forget this part.
And you're going to be happy.
I don't think it's going to be miraculously settled, unfortunately.
Well, I think you're a suspect for every murder that happens in L.A. over the next couple months.
What's going to happen is watch a lot of old Celtics games.
You're just going to blow up.
How much, if there is a lockout, what is that kind of hit for Ticketmaster?
Well, so here's the thing. We don't make that much money off of season tickets at all because there are no fees, right? So
yeah.
The weird way, there's another way of, it just used to be this way. I mean, and this is interesting, right? The fees get charged on concerts, individual game tickets. There are no fees on season tickets, right? So Ticketmaster and the teams have these weird incentives that are, we're trying to break those up by just sort of saying, pay us X per ticket, whatever it is. So the short answer there is, both with the NFL and the NBA, because there's a lot of season tickets, we don't make a whole ton of money on those.
Mm.
So, you know, as we've said publicly, and here's where I have to watch what I say, but we think we can manage it. And you are too. We're going to have basketball this year. I think it's just a question of when.
What about baseball? How'd that season go? Do you feel like the consumer habits have changed there? Because it almost feels like baseball's trapped in another time warp.
Yeah,
people want to go. They like taking their families. Like the numbers have been pretty similar to every.
Yeah, I mean, baseball would say that they finished the year up, right? I mean, I think that's what the attendance slightly up. But I think that is the place in particular where it's extreme because there's 81 games in a season ticket package. That's the place where big teams are seeing 10%, 15%, 20%+ declines in their season ticket holder subscriptions because people are just saying, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And the good news is that demand for the games hasn't changed, and there's actually a ton of opportunity if they can get pricing right.
Yeah.
Because people just want the right experience for them.
Because you're outdoors. It's fine. You can take your kids.
So that's where data comes in, right? So we're working with a big baseball team that you've historically rooted against, and they... I don't know. I can't remember. We're working with another team, right, who are looking at their stadium and saying, oh, my goodness, when we really drive in, it looks like the right side of the stadium, there's tons of demand. And, oh, the bleacher section of 50% of the seats in the bleacher section are being resold in the secondary market. Wow, okay, we're underpricing those. Let's solve that. Meanwhile, we've got open seats right next to home plate. What if we just took half the people who came to the bleachers and put them in those seats? They'd probably
almost
come
like
back
extras
and love us.
In the Oscars. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think baseball and all sports, you know, the challenge there is how do we recreate the perception of scarcity and not devalue the underlying product. And not saying that that's happening, but there's across, from Groupon and beyond, there's a threat that the underlying value of that product goes away. And I think these teams are waking up and realizing they got to use data. You know, it's taking Moneyball from the GM's office to the ticket seller's office and start to use data and analytics to profile every single fan and give them the best experience that's right for them. And that might be for $4, it might be for $400.
Is Groupon a threat to you?
No, we actually have a partnership with them.
Yeah, I thought, would you sign that, 6 months ago?
Yeah, we did. And I think at the core, we're trying to tackle that challenge of, okay, 40% of our inventory goes unsold. How do we find the person who has a little bit of money in their pocket tonight, doesn't know how to spend it, wants to know what's going on? Mm. 60% of fans say they would have come to another event if they'd only known about it. So, thinking about a portal strategy is web 1.5, maybe, you want to go fish where the fish are. And so it's why we're exclusively in Walmart now, because guess what? A lot of soccer moms walk through the door and go, oh my gosh, the circus is in town. I'm going to buy tickets right here. It's why we did the deal at Groupon to let people know what's out there. So, and we'll do another 25 big partnerships like that over the next couple of years to fish where the fish are.
Sounds like a fascinating couple of years ahead for you.
It's been fun.
Are you scale 1 to 10 optimistic that this will all settle in a really good place?
Well, I don't think it's going to settle. I think
it's
going to
constantly change.
I think the combination of technology and old school businesses undergoing massive amounts of change means that the next 10 years in this industry are going to be tumultuous. But that's all going to be behind the scenes. The fan doesn't necessarily see that. I think the only thing that comes out of that is good for the fan. Because when you have a troubled business, innovators and good ideas end up surfacing. And our job is to deliver that. But I think every other company in the space is trying to think about if they're smart, they're focusing on the fan. And that, as you know, is something that the sports teams in particular historically have done better than concerts, but I think the whole industry has to get there.
Do you want to share end zone season tickets with me in the new LA football stadium?
Yes, I do. I am in.
I'm so excited. Please don't put it in the city of industry.
No.
For the love of God, no.
They'll figure it out.
What do I have to do to not have this happen in the city of industry? Well, should I do an Occupy? Don't Occupy?
Occupy City of Industry.
Don't Occupy City of Industry. Or do Occupy. I forget how this works.
I don't know. But whatever it is, people will do it. Just tweet it.
All right. Nathan Hubbard, congrats on all the stuff you're doing on Ticketmaster. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for being so candid, too.
Thanks
about
for having
your industry.
Me.
Target to set off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.